So we have a couple of minutes for either of our speakers. If not, have a great lunch. Do you have a question?
You talk a little bit about how movies like The Phantom Empire with Gene Autry fit into the spectrum of country music and film and Western swing?
Well, Phantom Empire was, I think, Autry's second appearance in film. It's kind of notorious as just one of the most bizarre hybrids of genres. It's a Western science fiction film. Complete. We saw complete with, you know, a robot that wears a tin hat, and you know, he discovers this great. It's this big underground empire in Texas, right? With, you know, these evil people. Okay. yeah, I mean, he made his debut in a film that featured the guy who's really, really the first singing cowboy in Westerns, Ken Maynard. Yeah, thank you. And Maynard as a singer is totally different from Autry. He's actually a lot closer to traditional cowboy singing. But he appeared in a couple of Maynard films and clicked. He was already, at that point, he was established as a singer. And for some reason, they decided his first starring vehicle was going to be this 12 or 15 part serial. You know, The Phantom Empire, it's also known as Radio Ranch. That actually is the thing that made him a leading man. Watching it now, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to fathom. But it did. I don't think he ever made another science fiction film, and maybe that speaks to, you know, the power that he soon had as a star, that, you know, he could say, you know, Gene Autry meets Frankenstein. I don't think so. but yeah, I mean, the thing is that the audience for most of these B-Westerns was the young audience. So I don't think they were, you know, your 10-year-old kids were not going to be too upset by the idea of the outlandish plot of something like Phantom Empire. You know, Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon were just as crazy as that. Autry, I think, you know, really shaped the Westerns musically in that respect. And it's important to remember that while we remember things like Stagecoach and Rancho Notorious and so on as being, you know, the big classic Westerns, you know, 90% of the Westerns were the B-Westerns. The ones that featured, you know, Autry and Roy Rogers and other singing cowboys. They didn't all have music. There's a great quote from Buck Jones, who was a non-singing cowboy star, complaining about Autry and, you know, saying that he was having a hard time getting money to make his films because Autry's films were so cheap to make, because half the movie is just, you know, Autry leaning against a fence post strumming a guitar. I would say, all with the exception of Hawaiian Buckaroo, all the film clips that I showed were from, you know, pretty typical B Westerns. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah, this is for both of you, I think. The artists themselves sometimes are very much resist categorization. And I wonder if, in either case, for example, when Bob Wills is doing Big Beaver or something that just sounds miles away from country music, what do they say? Did you pick up much, and this could be either of you, in terms of what the artists themselves would say about where these things fall?
You wanna... Matt, I can address some of that.
I know some artists exploited the hillbilly image and went along with it because they knew it would sell. But a lot of the musicians were offended by it. And as you noticed, all the pictures of the Brownies, they were wearing pinstripe suits. And they considered themselves, they didn't consider themselves country musicians necessarily.
I can address part of this, is that in talking to many of these musicians, they were really ambivalent about what people thought of their music. Because the one thing that hasn't been mentioned in any of this is the function that Western swing served, and that was dancing. That was what it was all about. It had nothing to do with whether it was jazz or country. If people could dance to it, that's all they cared about. and that's all the musicians cared about.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, the Brownies, who didn't get to make any movies, yeah, they always wore good suits, and if you look at the pictures of the Light Crust Doughboys, when Wills and Brown were in that group, you know, they're either wearing suits or sometimes they show up dressed as Light Crust Flour factory workers, but never in cowboy gear. And I'm sure that if the later Light Crust Doughboys that appeared in Oh Susanna, you know, had shown up for a gig in Texas at that time dressed the way they were in that clip, they'd been laughed off the stage. You just didn't do that. But you know, that I think the movies actually played a major part in establishing and making that, you know, standard for Western swing groups to affect some kind of cowboy image.
And also at the same time that the movies were just starting, a big influence on the costumes of these bands was the Texas Centennial celebration of 1936 and 1937, where the Sons of the Pioneers played a big role. And it was really, that was the demarcation point. After 1936 and the Centennial, which was hugely successful, these bands started dressing up in cowboy outfits.
Yeah, and actually, the next film that Autry did, was it The Big Show, I think?
Yeah.
Takes place on the fairgrounds. And you get an early version of the Sons of the Pioneers featuring Roy Rogers. It's, you know, wonderful footage that memorializes, you know, what that exhibition looked like. And it you know, that one takes place in the present day. So it's, you know, the anachronisms abound in these films, and that one's no exception. But you get this wonderful cowboy music taking place against this spectacular Art Deco background.
Yeah, and another, and Carrie, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Brownies were slated to perform there, and that was right.
It was the same problem that why they did not end up in the Gene Autry film. They couldn't afford to pay them. They were earning $100 a show per person. And to appear in the Texas Centennial or in the Oh Susanna film, they would have had to forego several weeks of that kind of income. And the producers of both of the movie and the Centennial could not replace them. So it was Brown who turned down the offer. There was never any signing. Light Crust Doughboys was Autry's second choice.
Okay,
and,
am I wrong about
Autry, in fact, wrote
a letter
to that.
Am I wrong about
that
though? Because I thought that Brown had signed a contract to appear.
No, there was no signed contract.
Okay, sorry, didn't mean to mislead on that.
They turned it
then.
Down. I have a letter that Autry sent me.
Okay, that's
that
very
they couldn't
important.
Get Brown, and so okay. They signed the Doughboys.
Very important. That, thank you.
Matthew, Maddie, or Carrie, even, in your research, did you discover any black Western swing bands or any black Western swing performers? Mm-hmm. Or any black bands that played that type of music, whether they considered themselves Western swing band or not?
Well, you do get Herb Jeffries' films, which are made around 38, 39, and they kind of follow the model that had been set by Autry at that point. So you have Jeffries handling the ballads and an Inkspots type group, you know, handling the jazzier stuff. You do get some black performer. Well, actually, in The Big Show, the one on the fairgrounds there, I believe the Jones Boys appear in that. And there's an Autry film, I forget the name, in which a black quartet turns up to perform on the bill of a program that's going on, and they're, you know, done up in cowboy gear. A little later, in the mid-40s, there were a lot of these films made, features, which were ostensibly Westerns, but you know, the story is always the same. Somebody needs to raise a whole lot of money or they're gonna lose their ranch or something. And fortunately, they happen to know a lot of big singing stars, so they put on a show. there's one of those, name escapes me right now, but the Nat King Cole Trio appears in it, and they're wearing, you know, nice cowboy shirts and everything, and doing a version of River St. Marie that's really sweet. And also, there's a Soundy featuring a bass baritone named John Shadrach Horace. I don't know anything else about him, but he sings along the Navajo Trail, and most of the time, you know, he's got the cowboy outfit on. I think he's got a sombrero too, and he's walking across, you know, this cheap Western set, and there's a trio backing him up. You don't see him, but at the end, he finally enters the frame, and you see that he's being backed up by Charles Brown and his trio, and who are also done up in cowboy style. And you get to hear just a little bit of Charles Brown harmonizing with him at the end of it.
And obviously, the Brownies and a lot of those bands drew upon recordings of black entertainers like the Bill Brunzi and the Hokum Boys, and the Texas Playboys theme. You know, we're the Texas Playboys from the Lone Star State, was the Light Crust Doughboys theme, but before that it was Easy Riding Papa from Tennessee, and it was, you know, so they took it. They didn't get any credit for it.
Yeah. There was a lot of black and white interaction, of course, that didn't make it into the movies. Noah Boggs, for instance, knew Charlie Christian in Oklahoma and heard him play before he was ever with Benny Goodman. You know, so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of unwritten history there.
I can insert one comment about the Brownies and their relations to African Americans, and that's based on a statement that Fred Calhoun, their piano player, told me about them playing a dance one time out in the hinterland somewhere, and they kept hearing some cheering outside of the dance hall where they were, say, "Go, Papa," which was his nickname. And at intermission, Calhoun went out beside the barn or wherever the dance hall was that they were playing, and there was a railroad siding there, and there were some black railroad workers who were cheering. They were listening to the band, but they weren't allowed to enter the dance hall, so they listened from outside. So there were black people that did listen and were fans of the band. And Jay has a comment also.
You know, a couple of related points. The interaction between African Americans and country music, of course, a very complicated topic in Texas, which I can't begin to enter. You know, there's one very superficial example, and that would be Amos Milburn's Square Dance Boogie, which of course comes to mind as something that crossed those genres very plainly. But in the early 1950s, a group out of Mississippi, the Carroll County Boys, recorded for Modern Flair, and they cause endless confusion to record collectors today who are expecting a record on Modern Flair to be a heavy blues record or a vocal group record, and it turns out to be a country record. And as I understand it, that is an African-American band from Mississippi. So there's, you know, a lot of back and forth there. So they didn't make the movies, but there's no question about the cultural interchange.
And sometimes it's speculated, and I don't have a source in front of me, but Charlie, this was in a Gunther Schuller's History of Jazz, that Charlie Christian, growing up in Northeast Texas, was listening to the radio and listening to a lot of the Western swing that was on the radio, and his style of playing and electrifying his guitar may well have drawn from some of what he was hearing on the radio.
Listening to your presentation, it occurs to me that Western swing may very well be the only American music which never left the United States. It is and still was and always was a regional music, not even known in the eastern states of the United States, I believe. They were never on sale outside the United States. And the discographers, who were mostly Europeans, have never heard this and had no access to it because they were not in the catalogs. So they grew up with other records which were labeled jazz, and that defined their view of what is jazz and what is not jazz. So yeah. That may be one possible explanation of this phenomenon.
Well, I know there are several Western swing bands currently existing in Germany and in the Netherlands, and I'm a fan of them on Facebook. And anyway, I don't know at what point that happened, but...
There may have been some bands in Australia that were cowboy bands that did play with the swing style, but not known as Western swing
actually,
bands,
per se. If any of it received exposure in Europe, it might have been through the movies, right, if any of those B-Westerns made it over there.
I was just going to ask that. Yep. You demonstrated very amply that the movies, Hollywood, popularized this music, and the Westerns have been a very popular genre everywhere,
oh, yeah,
all over the world.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting... I think it's interesting to think about, well, who is the audience for these B-Westerns? Mostly kids. And, you know, so there you have 10 kids who are 10, 12 years old watching these movies early in the early and mid-40s and getting exposed to really, you know, this very cutting-edge music. And, you know, I certainly think it helped with getting national popularity for the music. And, you know, may have affected their tastes a few years later when they had enough money to buy records, and it may have, you know, that may have influenced them to buy R&B and early rock and roll.
I think that we can't overlook the effect of World War II. Mm-hmm. My dad, who really didn't care for Western swing, recalled hearing it when he was in the Army, stationed over in Europe and North Africa. It went out on the V-discs. There were also, of course, everybody from all over the country was thrown into various units. So you encountered people, he would have encountered people who listened to this stuff regularly, and it may be how some of the Europeans also were exposed to it. But
yeah.
I think the war certainly had a hand in exposing people outside the Southwest
mm-hmm.
to Western swing.
Yeah, well, and it was also really driving its popularity in California, because so many people had left the Southwest and gone to California because of the Depression and the Dust Bowl. And when the defense plants started cranking up and they were pulling triple shifts, those are the days of, you know, the legendary dances that Cooley and Wills played, the Santa Monica Pier, drawing 10 and 12,000 people, you know, with as big an audience as, you know, Glenn Miller or the Dorseys could draw.
I'm not going to make any claims here, but just an observation that the instrumentation and the insistence on a two-beat rather than a four-beat in Western swing mirrors what Django and Stepan Grappelli were doing in France. And I, whether or not there was any listening back and forth, I'm not the one to speculate, but I hear a great deal of similarity.
Oh, yeah.
In the two
yeah,
musics.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, anybody else? Thank you, a very
Thank you.
Engaging discussion here. Thank you very much.